Hey guys, how's things?
All right.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, I'm going to say a bunch of words. Well, it's a talk show. So, yeah. Hey, guess what, man? Our old friend David Bromwich is going to stop by. He's a professor of literature at Yale, and he speaks like one. And he's really good on stuff. I can't say that I know that he's been writing much about foreign policy lately. This one is the first one in a while that I know of anyway, but it could be that I just, wasn't paying attention. But I love it when this guy writes things and says things. He's really smart. And he's got, he's got the spotlight on antiwar.com today about Israel's fifth column in the United States of America and what it all means. And I think that'll be my question. What does it all mean? And then we'll see what he has to say. Good old Dave Bromwich. And Brad Hoff is going to be here. Our friend Brad Hoff from Levant Report. Now, you saw this, right? Spotlight on Friday. Or was it the spotlight over the weekend? No, Kelly was spotlight over the weekend. This was a spotlight on antiwar.com on Friday. Brad Hoff highlighting an interview, which, I don't have the guy's name in my notes anymore because it was on a different page. But an Al Jazeera interviewer who deserves to be named, he deserves to get the credit. Hang on, I have it here somewhere. Where the hell is it? This guy's name is Mehdi Hassan. See, I was almost even going to say that, but then I thought I better triple check first. Yeah, Mehdi Hassan is the name of this guy. He hosts a show called Head to Head on Al Jazeera, and he interviews Michael Flynn, the former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who's now, I guess, written a pro-war book and is doing a tour, a media tour, and that kind of thing. And this guy, Hassan, puts it to him about the DIA memo from 2012 about just what all they were conscious of when it came to the question of the rebellion in Syria being dominated by Salafist groups, namely Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria at the time, as it is known today, since then, the al-Nusra Front. It's just the Syrian-dominated faction of former Al-Qaeda in Iraq from Iraq War II. And anyway, so, yeah, man, it's a big deal. And what's going to happen is I'm going to play an edited clip, but it's all right because we're going to talk about the edit too. But the clip that I have to play is 2.5 minutes long or something as it is, and that's edited. And there's a lot of really important stuff in there. And then we'll talk about the edit is just, I cut out all the crap about, well, that's why I agree with Hillary that we should have supported the moderates better. And we will talk with Brad Hoff all about the mythical moderates and just how that was supposed to work. So I didn't edit that out, you know, for dishonesty's sake of the clip, only for brevity. But we will tackle the subject matter there. All right. So there you go. Now, let's see, what time is it? Okay, police state section. I'm not putting this off till Friday this week. We're doing the police state section. Hey, this is really important, man. Listen up. This is about your rights. Court rules warrantless cell phone tracking violates the Fourth Amendment. You're damn right it does. But now, here's the important thing that you need to know. Back in 1978... this guy, he had robbed the place, and then he kept making, I think it was a robbery. Maybe it was a rape. Anyway, he kept making threatening phone calls to the witness. And so the cops went to the phone company and said, hey, give us this guy's call records, and they proved, or her call records, no, his call records, and they proved that he'd been calling her. But they didn't have a warrant, and the judge allowed it. And then ultimately the Supreme Court upheld it and said that, well, geez, if you do business with someone and they have a record of the business that you do, well, then you have relinquished all expectation of privacy from the national or any other government knowing what it is that you're doing. What? What the hell is this? Communism or something? If you have a contract with Sprint, then any information that Sprint has on who you call and when and where you are as your phone is bouncing signals off of their towers is forfeit? Is the Attorney General of your state and the national government's private property not yours or Sprint's? Is that what it says in the contract? No. It's called the third-party doctrine, and it's just made up by the courts. You know, because they're co-conspirators with the police in violating your rights. Most of the time. But in this case, EFF lady Hani Fakori says, I think the tide is turning. What's happened here is a divided appellate court, divided, but still, ruled in Richmond, Virginia, ruled on Wednesday, last Wednesday, that citizens do not give up their privacy rights just because their mobile phone providers know where to reach them. And then, armed robbery. Aaron Graham, a man convicted of armed robbery after his cell phone location information over 7 months was obtained by the government from Sprint. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling rejected the third-party doctrine. Rejected it. Didn't say, well, in this case, we think. They rejected the third-party doctrine. A legal theory that private information held by a company is not protected by the Fourth Amendment's prohibitions against unreasonable search and seizure. That ruling acknowledged the prevalence and advancement of technology in our lives. People cannot be deemed to have volunteered to forfeit expectations of privacy by simply seeking active participation in a society through the use of their cell phones, the court wrote. ACLU and EFF both praised the decision. It looks like it's going to be appealed and go up to the Supreme Court. It was a 2-1 decision. Writing for the majority, the judge Andre Davis wrote, if the 21st century Fourth Amendment is to be a shrunken one, as the dissent proposes, we should leave that solemn task to our superiors in the majestic building on First Street and not presume to complete the task ourselves. Well, I don't know what the hell he meant by that. It sounds to me like they would need 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the 50 state legislatures and their governors to agree to pass resolutions ratifying the repeal of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That's the law. That's how you repeal amendments to the Constitution, with new amendments. Congress can't repeal the Fourth Amendment with a majority vote. That's what the good judge wrote. It's just like Edward Snowden saying, hey, as long as there's a public debate and people want to give their freedom away, no. If people want to debate and give my freedom away, they can suck it. How about that? My rights don't belong to you to be negotiated away. This is the guy with the, well, whatever. I really don't care if he's wrong on the issues. He still did a great thing by liberating all those documents, so it doesn't matter. You know, I saw a thing on Twitter where they were like, hey, look, here are the 5 important NSA whistleblowers that came out before Snowden. And I'm, you know, relatively familiar with all of their stories. But why is Snowden the big one? Because he left with the documents to prove it. Otherwise, the media never gave the benefit of the doubt to those others until he proved that they were telling the truth. Proved it. That's what it takes. Now he's in exile in Siberia over it. Because Obama left him stranded in Russia, the traitor. Obama, I mean. Hey, Al Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? $1.50? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. And thanks, y'all. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today at antiwar.com, Justin Raimondo has a review of the heroic Ron Paul's new book, Swords into Plowshares. If you go and check out the archives at scotthorton.org/interviews, about, what, a month and a half, 6 weeks ago or something, I interviewed Ron about that book. I think, Tom Wood said, hey, he kind of debuted the book. I forgot the word he used. Announced it on this show. In fact, he announced that he was writing a book about foreign policy on this show, an anti-war book on this show back when. I am truly honored. I love me some Ron Paul, man. I sure do. All right. One more police state thing for right now before we get back to the wars, and that is that it's the year anniversary of the slaying of Mike Brown by the coward Darren Wilson. And another guy was shot by the cops last night. I don't know enough about it to really tell you anything other than the guy's name is Tyrone Harris, and he's presumed innocent of what they accuse him of, which means I presume they are horrible, lying, murdering bastards. He's actually not dead. He had surgery and is in critical condition, last I heard. But even the official story, the last I heard it, was that undercover cops came up behind him, drove up behind him in a car, and that he turned around and shot at them, and that then they returned fire and took him down. So that sounds like the kind of thing where, in fact, I was just reading a thing where this other guy that they killed, they said, well, yeah, he drove at us. And it wasn't even believable either. It was, it was kind of believable. The carjacking guy, the Andre, whoever, the kid from another guy last night. The cops said, last night, same night, in a different place. The cops killed a kid, a 15-year-old, who apparently had stolen a car. They say, you know, carjacking, so, but they didn't describe someone being pulled out of the car at gunpoint or anything necessarily, so I don't know that that's true. Again, presumed innocent. But they said, hey, he drove at us. So we waxed him. So good enough for them. Exact same excuse for Tyrone Harris. They were driving at him. He was defending himself. A car is a deadly weapon. Justifiable homicide. Or attempted. Right? Or where am I going off the story here? The cops are His Highness's Royal Praetorians, and they have the right to murder whoever they feel like, and us plebs have no right to defend ourselves from them even? Is that the law? That's not the law, actually. But then what is the law? What they say and get away with, or what the piece of paper says written on it? Right, exactly, the former. I know I should have given the multiple choices in the other order, but still. And then I want to say another thing about the Mike Brown thing real quick, and that is the argument about how Mike Brown's no angel. Same thing for this guy, Andre, last night accused of stealing a car. Nothing that Mike Brown did deserved being put to death. And maybe this changed, but I don't think so. The chief of police and all of them admitted from the beginning that when Darren Wilson, the cop, creeped up on Mike Brown, he had no idea or did not make the connection. Maybe he had heard on the radio, but admitted that he did not make the connection that maybe this kid walking down the middle of the road is the kid from the radio report of the stolen cigars at the Quickie Mart. He was just basically being a jerk, telling him to stop walking in the middle of the street, even though they're way, you know, on the dead end of the neighborhood. There's no traffic. It's a Saturday morning. He's not obstructing anything. The cop picks the fight with him, pulls the gun on him. Mike Brown prevents himself from being shot to death then, turns around to run away. The cop fires and misses. He stops, turns around with his hands up. I know people admitted that they lied and said they saw his hands up. But other people admitted no such thing and swore that, yeah, no, I saw him. He turned with his hands up, including, if this makes it, you know, easier for you, the white work crew that was there that I saw on TV. He turned around like this. Sean Hannity said, oh, he charged at him 100 times, quoting a lady who even the DA admits she perjured her entire testimony. She wasn't there at all. Charged him like a football player. And Darren Wilson, I swear to God this is true, dude. Double check me if you think I'm lying. Darren Wilson, the cop, told the grand jury that it turned into a demon and bulked up to run through the bullets. What does that mean? He's not a human. He's got no right to live in the first place. He's with magical evil powers. So never mind the fact that Darren Wilson is 6'4 and, you know, in a lot better shape than Mike Brown. He had magical demon it powers as he bulked up to run through the bullets, which is just words that don't go together in that order and couldn't possibly. What the does it mean to run through a bullet? You can't run through a bullet. You can run toward a bullet and then the bullet will go through you. The only way to go through a bullet then would be to shrink down to the size of an electron, I guess. And then somehow vibrate at just the right frequency where you go through the bullet. Otherwise, that's just stupid. That's just a stupid lie. But of course, the grand jury is stacked with a bunch of government employees and their spouses and is run by the district attorney. And so, it didn't really matter. But anyway, back to my point I was going to try to make before I went telling the whole damn story again, is the whole he's no angel thing. Guess what? Nobody is. If everybody knew everything about you, come on. Remember that thing you did? Give me a break. So what if he stole some cigars? The penalty for that is not death. Although, actually, at the time, if the store owner had pulled his gun and fired, that would have been justified in the middle of actually using physical force. Or at least he would have been justified in pulling the gun and tell him, get the hell out of here, or drop the cigars, or whatever. I think even shooting him at that point, he would have been within his right to do so. But the cop murdering him later, after picking a fight with him, and pulling his gun on him for no reason, and then firing on him and missing, and then shooting at him when he's putting his hands up to surrender? Come on. Same thing with this kid who supposedly was a carjacker last night. The person who was being carjacked? Assuming that is true, which I don't, but I'm saying for the sake of argument. Assuming that's true, the person being carjacked had a right to pull a gun and shoot this kid, 15 years old or 35. But according to the cops, oh, he drove at us? I mean, even then, yeah, maybe, but I don't believe it. You think the cops were really cornered and had no choice? I presume he was innocent and they were lying. But anyway, oh, carjacker. The penalty for that's not death. Not summary execution on the street by the deputy sheriff.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. All right, guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm really excited about talking with David Bromwich again here in a little while, man. I really like that guy. You'll want to hear him say stuff, I think. I'm going to get to Iran in just a second. This is just a couple of, I guess more or less miscellaneous news stories. Not that they're not important, just that I don't have that much to say about them. First of all, is the death of Tyler Drumheller. Is notable, former CIA officer who exposed the Curveball story, dies at 63. And Curveball was the guy who was the brother of an aide to Ahmed Chalabi, he was his own agent of influence first, I guess, but Iran's agent second, sent to lie the Israel First neoconservative fifth column into believing that a war against Saddam Hussein would benefit Israel. And boy, did it work. And anyway, so Curveball is the one who they sent to tell German intelligence, to tell the Americans that he knew all they needed to know about Iraq's secret biological weapons program. Remember Colin Powell held up little just cartoons, drawings of trucks and said, yeah, these are their mobile biological weapons laboratories. Uh-huh. Those are some nice artist depictions of what they might look like if they actually existed. What a bunch of crap. But anyway, good enough to convince your mom and dad to support an aggressive war, right? Maybe even you. Well, look, I mean, that's a pretty damn convincing cartoon. Where do you think they got the idea from for that cartoon? Probably something real, right? Right? But anyway, here's why I'm interested in Drumheller and his death this week. It's because of this story from June the 17th. Tyler Drumheller was the man behind Hillary Clinton's private Libya intel, sources say. And this one is from ABC. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had access to the world's top intelligence agencies and their resources. But at the most turbulent moment of her tenure as the nation's top diplomat, God dang it, Bobby. Sorry, I got automatically logged out of something here. That's a nice way to lose my place. All right, I'll try that again. But at the most turbulent moment of her tenure as the nation's top diplomat, she retrieved a stream. Oh, yeah, you try talking out loud. See if you can do it right. She received a stream of intelligence on Libya and the Benghazi attack by a former CIA official working outside the government. Sidney Blumenthal, that's Max Blumenthal's father and Clintonista, a confidant who was paid by the Clinton Foundation, told the Select Committee on Benghazi Tuesday that the information he supplied to the sitting Secretary of State came from a respected former high-ranking CIA official. Rankling Republicans charged with investigating, blah, blah, blah. We have the CIA, so why would you have your own source? Rail some Republican. And then, okay, I should have read this whole thing already. I guess they're not going to be specific about whether that's where they got the story of the Viagra and the mass rapes. Whether that's where they got the story of the impending massacre of every man, woman, and child in Benghazi. Was Drumheller the debunker of the Curveball information after it was way, way, way too late, by the way? Was he the source of those lies? And is it possible that he was murdered because of his relationship with Hillary Clinton in the Libya war? You know, I'm not saying that he surely was, and most of these CIA guys are big, fat, red meat-eating, cigar-chomping, hard liquor-swilling, kind of heart attack-having sort of dudes, so... You know, I don't know. They say died at the hospital. Oh, pancreatic cancer. Yeah, that'll get you, man. Damn. Oh, there you go. Never mind. But anyway, I just like taking note that we live in a country where
somebody like this dies, there's a question anyway. How'd he die anyway? Yeah. All right. Well, pancreatic cancer. Yeah, that'll do you, dude. Sorry. Hope I don't get that. All right, but anyway, so yeah, whatever. I still had a chance, never mind the assassination angle, I still had a chance, an opportunity to bring up Hillary Clinton's leading role in getting us into that Libyan war. And what a disaster it's been, so that's good. And I did have another Libya story here somewhere too, didn't I? ISIS pushes into eastern Libya's Derna, bombing kills 7. Derna was Libyan ISIS's original home city. That's at news.antiwar.com. Okay, also, the so-called price tag attack, where this is how this works. Israeli settlers, if the Israeli government ever, like if the courts ever rule against them on anything, then they attack innocent Palestinians as the price tag for the government trying to curb their will in any way whatsoever. And what they did was they burned an 18-month-old baby to death a couple of weeks ago. And now his father has died as well. And, of course, all of this happening on the West Bank of the Jordan River, which is occupied territory where the Palestinians live but have no rights. Where Palestinians don't have the right to the land they live on. But Jews from Ukraine, from England, from Texas have the right to their property. But they don't. And all subsidized by the United States of America. And with military, you know, weaponry and plus money too. That's how it works. Oh no, they hate us because we're free. You know. Because otherwise I might have to like explain it to you. All right. And then the other kind of miscellaneous thing I wanted to get to on the show today was Jesse Benton's indictment. Jesse Benton and some other guy and what they did. And I think we've heard the tape of this already, right? Didn't they have the audio of this back a couple years ago or something? Anyway, at least the transcript. They were busted hiring a Bachman supporter in 2012 and paying him by way of, you know, money laundering type of a, or, you know, payment laundering kind of an operation where they paid him through a media company to switch his support from Bachman to Ron. And to Ron Paul. And, oh yeah, if you don't know who Jesse Benton is, he's the former Ron Paul and now Rand Paul staffer that everybody hates the most. Well, now he's, running, one of Rand's super PACs. But he was the guy that all the real libertarians were, you know, slamming our heads into the wall, going, God, this guy's ruining everything for all of 2007 and 8 and 11 and 12, too. But anyway, so now it turns out that they're being investigated as well for this elaborate plan to lure a couple away from their home with a free surprise donated vacation to Kennebunkport, Maine, home of George H.W. Bush, where then they broke into their house and stole their son's laptop computer. And it was, I don't know if it was Benton himself, but it was Benton, his buddy, and his buddy basically were the ring here. And I presume they're guilty because Jesse Benton is a snake. And this sounds like the worst thing they could do, basically, right? So, must be right. These idiots. But anyway, it's just kind of cuckoo when you look at this thing. Like, how do they think they're going to get away with that? Family goes on vacation. They didn't, like, apparently, they didn't just steal the hard drive out of the laptop but leave it sitting there where maybe the parents wouldn't notice or something. They stole the laptop. That's funny. Someone anonymously donated us a vacation away from home for the weekend, and then while we're gone, someone steals, breaks into our house and steals only our son's laptop. I wonder if it could have anything to do with those indicted friends of his from that political campaign that he was working on. What a disgrace. Jesus. Okay. Schumer and the Iran deal next. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. So, hey, man, Friday night I did a show with Jeff Tucker, Eye on the Empire, at liberty.me. Just go to liberty.me. You should sign up, man. You can be my friend on there. Just go to liberty.me and click the blue live button. Video, interviews, and events. That blue live button will take you to it. You'll see it right there, Eye on the Empire, and it has the Eye of Sauron. Which I thought what it should be is it should be, is it Pippin or is it Merry that looks into the Palantir? And he's going, ah! Because he's looking straight in the eye of Sauron. That should be the picture, right? Where Tucker is the Hobbit and the Empire is the on the other side of the crystal ball there. Anyway, I guess I could be the Hobbit. I probably look more like a Hobbit than Tucker does. Anyway. Yeah, this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, Jeffrey Lewis wrote a thing. And I'm not always the most biggestest, Jeffrey Lewis fan, but you know what? I don't know. He's alright. He's a nuclear scientist type. And, I think most of the time pretty genuine. And he wrote a thing for Foreign Policy, which of course now I can't find. Where the hell is it? I had it right here. Didn't I? I don't know. I guess I didn't. Anyway, it's at foreignpolicy.com. And what it's about is it's about how Chuck Schumer, yeah, he's a liar. Now we're going to be talking all about Chuck Schumer and the politics of all this with David Bromwich coming up. And Lewis doesn't call him a liar, but yeah, pretty much he does. Because, well, here, let me get the headline for you here. Foreign. I thought I had a link to it. Anyway, look, the biggest lie in there, I can tell you off the top of my head, there's more. But, the biggest one is, oh, no, we don't have, ready access inspections. They promised us, regular inspections, and we don't get them. That is such a lie. And in fact, the way Jeffrey Lewis treats that lie, I think he does a really good job with it. He says, you take one little thing, you twist it completely out of context, you repeat it over and over again, you make a whole new thing out of it. Where it's 99% of a lie, if not 100. The headline is Chuck Schumer's disingenuous Iran deal argument. By Jeffrey Lewis at Foreign Policy. And so here is the real deal. The real deal is that the IAEA will have absolute 24-hour on-station inspections and full-scale monitoring of all of Iran's nuclear program. All of it. 24 hours a day. Some white-coated IAEA bureaucrat with a tricorder sitting there going beep, 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 and making sure that nobody's cheating. At their minds. See, they already had a safeguards agreement. Now they have an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement. At their mines, at their centrifuge facilities where they don't even have any, you know, actual nuclear material. They're just making the hardware for enriching it. At the plant where they refine the ore to yellow cake. At the plant where they transform the yellow cake into uranium hexafluoride gas for introduction into the centrifuges. At Natanz, where they're actually enriching the uranium hexafluoride gas up to a measly 3.6% U-235. IAEA nuclear cops everywhere. The whole time, at all of it. At all of it. Now, what does not have 24-hour inspection in Iran?
every last piece of property in Iran. Every last military base in Iran. Yeah, well, so what? Do you think that there's an honest person in this world who would argue that you could get a better deal with Iran where they agree to 24-hour, full-scale, on-site inspections of all of their military bases that have nothing to do with nuclear material whatsoever? Come on. And as Jeffrey Lewis points out, if they think that there's a, quote, suspected site, they can show right up and demand access. That's what the deal says. And if Iran tries to block the door and invoke all of their delaying tactics, which could only last for a week or so anyway, a couple of weeks anyway, then the game would be up at that point. First of all, there is no way they could hide an entire nuclear weapons program. The worst accusation is they could hide small experiments without any nuclear material, focusing on just this small aspect or that small aspect of developing a nuclear weapon. But they could, what, hide their own Sandia National Laboratory at Parchin without everyone knowing? Or if the IAEA showed up and said, aha, we think that you're doing something in there. You don't mind let us looking in the back room, that they could then cover that up within a couple of weeks and get away with it without the National Reconnaissance Office having their ass. Right. In other words, it's a disingenuous argument. It's just a talking point. It's an excuse that this hack, at best, this traitor, more accurately, Charles Schumer, is attempting to invoke, just like Rand Paul lying to try to justify his opposition to this deal. Because there are no actual arguments against it that are worth a damn. I am willing to entertain, no, I insist, on complete abolition of the U.S. government in all forms, and so all sanctions would be lifted anyway under my plan and that kind of thing, which, you know, I understand. Believe me, that's my position too, but real world here. Is it better to have this deal than not? Absolutely. And all it is a deal, despite all the hype that you hear. All that the deal is for the U.S. to lift all their sanctions on Iran that were put on them in the name of preventing them from making nuclear weapons. And in exchange, the Iranians are adopting an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement, expanding inspections beyond any other inspections regime in the history of the world, and also curtailing their nuclear weapons curtailing their nuclear program back to much smaller degrees than it is now, going from 20,000 centrifuges down to 5,000, closing down the Fordo plant, converting the Iraq reactor from a heavy water reactor to a light water reactor that will not produce weapons-grade plutonium, shipping all of their waste out of the country to Russia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's all the deal is. You're a bunch of hooing and hawing and hype and crying. Remember that letter I read to you, the email I got that I read to you on the show last week, where the guy said he talked to his staffer, his congressman staffer, and the staffer admitted to him that everyone who's calling in opposition to the deal, when I ask them why, they can't say why. They don't know anything about it. They don't have any real thing to oppose other than you better not do this because APEC sent me. That's all they got to say. And meanwhile, here's, you know, a regular listener to this show, regular reader of antiwar.com, and Gareth Porter, who calls up his, or goes to visit, I don't know, his congressman staffer, and says, look, here's the truth, let me break it down for you, tells the story. They know he's right. There's no question he's right. There's no question that he knows what he's talking about, and everybody else is running around chanting slogans that the government of a foreign nation told them to chant. Oh, better deal. We get a better deal. Yeah. Anyway, and I like the way Jeffrey Lewis attacks Schumer's integrity in other ways in here, too. He doesn't have integrity. The guy's scum. And he's a liar. And so, as Jeffrey Lewis points out, yes, they have continuous inspections at all of their nuclear sites. And then, let me see here. Where this... I'm trying to find the other parts that he debunks. I think he mostly just sticks with that, the spin on the inspections. Yosef Butt had a great article at The Hill, too, talking about how to give Iran too much to lose. Make this deal with them. I was trying to get him on the show today, but I didn't reach him in time. Maybe tomorrow. But that's a good one to take a look at. Giving Iran Too Much to Lose by Yosef Butt at The Hill. As well as Jeffrey Lewis at foreignpolicy.com. Chuck Schumer's disingenuous Iran deal argument. We'll be right back.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I promise we're going to be replacing those Onion News things soon. Jeremy, you listening? I need that second audio montage thing, dude. We can't stand it anymore. Am I right, everybody? You hear them all agreeing? It's unanimous. All right. Hey, on to our first guest on the show today. It's our old friend David Bromwich, professor of literature at Yale University and author of many books, including, I believe, the editor of Edmund Burke's Selected Writings on Empire, Liberty, and Reform. Believe that. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, David?
Very good to be with you.
Very happy to have you here. Very important piece, a very probably controversial piece you've written here. At the Huffington Post, Netanyahu and his marionettes. Well, so I was reading in the tablet about how you are an anti-Semite. If you say,
did they say that? I hadn't found that yet.
No. Not you personally, but anyone, I meant to say,
right.
who says that Jewishness or the Israel lobby or Israel have anything to do with Israel trying to get American Jews to join the Israel lobby to stop the Iran deal. So how do you defend yourself from that horrible accusation?
It's a secret in plain view and declared with great pride by the people who are executing the connections. I mean, when Sheldon Adelson went more than public, went exhibitionist with his support of Mitt Romney in Jerusalem, bringing with him several other billionaires to defeat Obama and to do that in Jerusalem, not in Washington, D.C., I mean, that made things pretty clear, and we've seen since then the host, or should I say, you know, series of Republican aspirants to the presidential nomination, you know, making their way to Las Vegas to do sort of auditions for Adelson. I mean, it's well known that that's what's on his mind. He has said that he served the U.S. Armed Forces in uniform, but he wishes he had been in an Israeli uniform. So, I mean, you know, that's connecting the links, dotting the I's and crossing the T's, but it's already been done in newspaper stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is almost unbelievable. I don't know. Maybe it's not. Netanyahu addresses American Jews. Three reasons to oppose the Iran deal. So
yeah,
not just
a, I mean, anybody could tune in.
Sure.
It's like the President of the United States giving his weekly radio address. Anybody could tune in. It becomes a podcast that's, universally accessible, but it was billed as an address to American Jews, and I don't think that's ever been done. I don't think the leader of a foreign power has ever picked out an ethnic group or a nationality or a race among Americans and said, from the foreign power to the Americans, I'm talking to you within America so you'll know how to act on our behalf, the foreign power.
All right, now, but see, you sound like an anti-Semite again.
Well, I'm simply stating that this is historically unprecedented in the United States, as far as I know. It's not unprecedented that there be, you know, interest external to the United States, interest backed by large, you know, finance internal to the United States that want to throw their weight around. That's allowed, of course. But Netanyahu is in a different category from previous leaders that we've seen in Israel or elsewhere, and I would distinguish him from all previous Israeli leaders. He was indeed criticized on Friday in an interview published in the Israeli paper Maariv by the president of Israel, Reuben Rivlin, who said that you know, Netanyahu's conduct was terribly worrisome to Israelis, and that the kind of conflict he was setting up between Obama and himself was something to be avoided. So I think he's felt to be extreme by all except the settler movement that are his party base, his coalition base in Israel. Mm-hmm. But in the United States, in the mainstream media, the coverage is much more subdued, almost, I don't know what to say. I mean, there's a degree of understatement or slant in the mainstream coverage of this that really prevents Americans who, you know, aren't very attentive from seeing quite what's happening.
Mm. Well, and although I'm not so sure of that, I mean, this seems like, I mean, the president himself said it in his speech that, look, there's only one force on earth that's against this deal, the Israelis and their lobbyists in D.C. I mean, he wasn't exactly that explicit, but pretty much.
Yes, he was. And Obama hates to be polemical. And, I mean, I've criticized him for this before. I think he has a kind of aversion to sharp definitions of anything. It's the way his personality and his politics are built. He co-opts. He does not separate. But in this case, he was very explicit, very sharp, and with great warrant. He spoke with complete propriety when he said, and he didn't name the neoconservatives, but he all but named them, when he said these are the people who pressed for the Iraq War, and they were wrong then, and you should be suspicious whether they're right now.
Yeah. All right, now, so in the article, and I want to get back to D.C. and the politics some more in a minute, but you tell some really important history here. When you talk about Netanyahu's first term in office and how it was that he even came to power, what it was that he was about back then in 1996.
Yeah, well, in 1996, he was the, you know, the anti-Oslo candidate, the alarmist about, you know, the dangers of giving in to the Palestinians in any way. And he was, in that sense, in rebellion against U.S. policy and Israeli stated policy at the time. The defender of the Oslo Accords was Yitzhak Rabin, who had a great and respected military and political record in Israel, but took the risk and said, we have to get this problem solved. It's a long-standing one, and we have to come to terms with it. He was assassinated by a greater Israel religious fanatic. Netanyahu ascended to power in the election that followed. He was accused by many of playing up to the dangerous right-wing crowd sentiment that was, you know, not unrelated to the politics of the assassin. But anyway, that was where he came into power, and shortly after that, he received, I don't know when it was publicized, but it was publicized not too long after, he received a memorandum from a group of American conservatives, mainly Richard Perl, the author of it, but also David Wormser, Douglas Feith, notable other names on the document, advising to make a clean break. That was the title of the memorandum, a clean break with its previous stance in the region and its previous stance toward the United States, and to devote itself to removing Saddam Hussein from Iraq, attacking the interests and assets of Syria wherever possible with a view to separating Syria into several parts, and making sure that it weakened Iran with a view to whatever in the distant future on Iran. So, I mean, as I see it, but again, this is hardly more of a construal than the business of Netanyahu's connections with American financiers. It is a plan that disclosed in 1996 to let Israel stand alone as a solid potential partner in the region and subvert all the other conceivably stable, conceivably advantageous countries to be allied with for the U.S. And I think he's been following that plan. I think that Netanyahu is in close accord and consultation with the neoconservatives has been since the late 90s. And I think he believes that they are political geniuses. He follows pretty much the same steps, or they follow his interest, it's not important to say, which is the initiator.
All right. So, in other words, if I can oversimplify this, you tell me if I'm oversimplifying it too much. But they're basically saying, forget peaceful coexistence with our neighbors other than maybe Egypt or and Jordan. Maybe
Egypt
not even
Jordan.
Them. Let's go ahead and we rather just have permanent enmity, but with us in a position of so much power that nobody else can do anything about it. And that's it. That's the clean break.
Yeah. And I can continue maybe after the break.
Yeah, there you go. We'll let you be more specific when we get back. It's David Bromwich writing at the Huffington Post, Netanyahu and his marionettes. We'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with David Bromwich. Writing at the Huffington Post, Netanyahu and his marionettes. Their attempt to scotch the Iran deal. And we're talking about the basis of Netanyahu's worldview here. Back when he was the prime minister the first time in the famous clean break document. Oh, this is a slight quibble, David. I think David Wurmser was actually the principal author of that document. That they all Pearl in the
rest. No, it was Pearl.
No, are you certain?
I'm looking at it right now, yeah. Group lead, so study group leader. Wurmser was one of the group.
Well, I think he's the one that wrote it and then put everybody else's name on it. I'm not sure what they call themselves, but there's an interview with Wurmser with the Wall Street Journal.
It is a disagreement then, Scott, because I think Richard Pearl is the sort of charismatic character among all that lot.
Yeah. There was a fight where Feith said, well, I didn't even write it all. He asked me a couple of questions and then he put my name on it and I didn't even write the thing and went crying about it. And then they kind of explain. I think there's an interview in the Wall Street Journal. I'll try to find
it.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's a minor point. They did all sign on to it. Pearl and Wurmser certainly are of the same mind on the question.
Pearl is the name at the top. It says study group leader. So yeah. That's why I said him.
Yeah. I dig. All right. Anyway, and everybody, you can find that. And also, the companion article is called Coping with Crumbling States. And they're both at scotthorton.org in the fair use category there because the original think tank took them down.
Also in Information Clearinghouse. It used to be available at the Project for the New American Century outlet, and it's related to the group of people who were involved in that.
Right, very same guys. And here's what's funny about this to me, and you could disagree all you want and say whatever you want about it, but this seems completely foolish and ridiculous to me. Of course Israel could have peace with all their neighbors and last for hundreds of years probably if they would go back to 48 or 67 borders, whatever you call them, and treat their neighbors with respect. And this goes back to the Yanan plan, Oded Yanan from 1980 or 81, where he goes,
all is lost. World communism is going to conquer the whole world, and we're all going to starve and die, and there's no hope at all except for, you know, complete and total retrenchment against our enemies everywhere that surround us. And it's just crazy. Like, that's not the world that we're living in at all.
Well, I understand Israel's fears, or the fears of Israelis. They have been attacked, often surprise attacks. In the past, in 67, where they launched a preemptive attack against the armies massing around them, but in 73, during Yom Kippur, it really did hit them hard. And again, in the Second Intifada, where you had terrorists setting off suicide bombs inside restaurants and whatnot, it is a dangerous place. It is a hard part of the world to be living in. But that's where the State of Israel chose to set up, and for reasons to do with ideas about the ancient covenant, which only religious fanatics in Israel would defend as a political basis for what the state wants to be. But I agree with you and with all the, you know, sensible people in this argument, including a great many in Israel who are not heard from in the United States, that given that that's their neighborhood, they have to try to live in it, and the effort hasn't been made, not convincingly, since 1967 when they took the territories that they now occupy. And, you know, this document, the Netanyahu founding document, let's call it, from 1996, essentially advises him to discard the boring and unavailing policy of conflict management, their word for diplomacy, get rid of that, and try to appeal to the U.S. as your only significant ally, a shared philosophy of peace through strength. It also advises Netanyahu to use familiar American watchwords. It says that, appeal to them in the language they understand, such as self-reliance and so on. Then in a remarkable sort of rhetorical turn near the end of the thing, it says, but this will lead to peace, even though we're going to separate ourselves from all our neighbors and try to subvert them. It will lead to peace, because it will mean we no longer have to simply manage the Arab-Israeli conflict. We will transcend it.
Right.
Transcend it, because we're beyond all wars, because all of our neighbors have been rendered completely incapable by us. Yeah.
Right. And what's funny, too, of course, is just how completely Crystallian their predictions are about how this is all supposed to take place. The Shia majority of Iraq, once we get rid of Saddam Hussein, they're going to put in a Hashemite king, because they love stuff like that. And then that's going to inspire the people of Iran to rise up against the Ayatollahs. And this is going to getting rid of Saddam is going to be the worst thing that ever happened to the Ayatollah, they say.
Right. That word Hashemite is used again and again to lend a veneer of scholarship and, you know, deep Middle Eastern lore to these extraordinarily shallow and, fast shot American recommendations. Anyway, that's the past.
Yeah.
When I used the word marionettes, I didn't mainly have in mind, just the Israel lobby and its hundreds descending on Congress, but also the congressmen and congresswomen themselves, who in the middle of this difficult period, when a vote is pending, the Iran review vote by Senate, actually agree to take a paid-for trip to Jerusalem, 58 of them. And this is, I mean, this to me is the most mouth-opening aspect of our peculiar moment. How could you do this? How could you be a member of Congress at this moment, at this exigent moment, and say, all right, we know that there's a division between the Israeli prime minister and the American president. A lot hangs on this. Say I want to vote for the overturn of the Iraq agreement. Say I want to oppose the president on this. Say I hope that we get two-thirds and we can really knock it down. Still, just for the appearance of the thing, what on earth would drive me to go to Israel at this moment? And again, I find that unprecedented. And it would be so easy for any member of Congress to say, hey, I'm with you. I'm going to vote the way you want me to, but this just looks bad. I can't go to Israel right now. Let me go next year. But they don't do it.
Well, and the lobby's answer is, no, it looks bad to us if you refuse to come. And so that's what they're weighing. Obama's going to be gone in 2 years, but Israel's not going anywhere. Neither's AIPAC. Yep. And yeah, especially the House members, they got to keep running basically perpetually. They're reelected every 2 years.
There may have been a lot of pressure for them to do it right now. I don't know. But one of my thoughts, it's not in the article, but, you know, might prompt others to think it too, is that Netanyahu here is playing the long game. That's just what you're saying too now. I mean, he doesn't necessarily expect to overturn the agreement by a two-thirds or more vote sufficient to override the president's veto in Congress. But he is trying, with all the massive force and funds at his disposal, to change American opinion so that it is so convincingly against this treaty that no American politician will want to venture to oppose public opinion. It will be much harder to take a stand in favor of the treaty than it had been before. I mean, what this will mean in international politics isn't clear at all, because the European powers and Russia and China having signed on to it, it's really hard to believe that they will just keep the sanctions in place against their own economic and political interests. But Netanyahu dwells with great familiarity in the element of chaos. And I think the disorder of the world that would follow from American politicians feeling unable to go with the agreement in the future, I think that would suit him fine. Yeah. And it's just this that has made the more prudential members of the Israeli defense and security establishment almost unanimously turn against him. It's only people in his cabinet who support him. And as I was just saying, the president of Israel has already registered a dissent, but he's a rather ceremonial officer. Mm-hmm. But the stories about this you do not find in the Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN or CBS or NBC. Right. You find it in the American Jewish newspaper Forward in a couple of excellent articles by J.J. Goldberg, where he says, you know, all the weight of the mind and knowledge of the Israeli defense and security establishment that's not in power right now is in favor of accepting the deal.
In other words, all of the former heads of Mossad and Shin Bet and the highest ranking generals.
Mossad, which is their CIA, Shin Bet, which is their FBI. Yeah, the people, and, you know, a guy like Amos Yadlin, who is the, you know, defense, I don't know what to say, you know, their master of defense in Israel. And, you know, in America, you've had the letter from several past ambassadors to Israel and foreign service officers, including Frank Wisner, who's, you know, practically all but there at the founding of the CIA, Thomas Pickering, Nicholas Burns, and others supporting the deal. And then what the Times reported just yesterday, the 29 U.S. scientists, including, what is it, 6 Nobel Prize winners, including people who worked on nuclear weapons, saying that they support the Iran deal. And these are the people most qualified of all in the United States to say whether the inspections regime is adequate and rigorous enough. And yet, public opinion, with all the money Obama rightly spoke of, and with all the weight of Netanyahu's will behind it, American opinion is turning little by little against the deal. Yeah. It's not clear it'll go all the way, but, you know, Chuck Schumer's weighing in, opposing his own party leader, is a symptom.
Right. Yeah, and I'm sorry, we're just over time and got to go, but thank you so much for coming back on the show, David. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks.
Sure, appreciate it. All right, y'all, that is David Bromwich, and I'm sorry because I had more things to ask him, obviously, there, but all out of time. HuffingtonPost.com, Netanyahu and his marionettes. We'll be right back in just a sec with Brad Hoff.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I like this song too, man, but we got to get back to the interviews here. Yeah, I went overtime with David Bromwich. I wish I'd had a whole hour with him, man. There's so much more to discuss there. But check out his article. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Next is Brad Hoff. He was the spotlight on antiwar.com last Friday. With his piece about the war in Syria. Former DIA chief warned White House of ISIS rise. The website is LevantReport.com. Welcome back to the show, Brad. How are you doing?
Thanks so much for having me back, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Now, so here's the deal. You broke the story. I'm just going to catch everybody up here real quick. You broke the story about the Judicial Watch FOIA suit that resulted in the revelation of this DIA memo from August of 2012 explaining how America's allies in the war in Syria were helping back a bunch of al-Qaeda suicide bomber kooks, and that they were looked like they wanted to carve out an Islamic state in eastern Syria, and that there was a danger that it could spread into western Iraq. And it didn't get that much coverage except in alternative type media. But anyway, so here a guy named Mehdi Hassan has gotten an interview with Michael Flynn, the former head of the DIA, who was head of the DIA at that time. And this Al Jazeera reporter, Mehdi Hassan, confronted Michael Flynn about this memo. And I have here that clip. It's slightly edited, but not for deception, just for time. And I'll explain further when we get back from this clip. It's about 2.5 minutes long, Brad. I'll thank you for your patience, but the audience needs to hear this.
And a secret analysis by the agency you ran, the Defense Intelligence Agency, in August 2012 said, and I quote, there is the possibility of establishing a undeclared Salafist, it's not secret anymore, was released under FOI. The quote is, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime. The US saw the ISIL caliphate coming and did nothing. Did you see this document in 2012? Was this come across your table?
Yeah. I paid very close attention to all this.
So when you saw this, did you not pick up a phone and saying, what on earth are we doing supporting these Syrian rebels?
That kind of information is presented. And
what did you
do about I argued about it.
Did you say we shouldn't be supporting these groups?
I did. I mean, we argued about the different groups that were there. And we said, you know, who is it that is involved here? And I will tell you that I do believe that the intelligence was very clear. And now it's a matter of whether or not policy is going to be as clear and as defining and as precise as it needs to be. And I don't believe it was.
But in 2012,
but
3 years ago, let's just be clear, just for the sake of our viewers. In 2012, your agency was saying, quote, the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda in Iraq are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria. Mm-hmm. In 2012, the U.S. was helping coordinate arms transfers to those same groups. Why did you not stop that if you're worried about the rise of quote-unquote Islamic extremism?
I mean, I hate to say it's not my job, but my job was to ensure that the accuracy of our intelligence that was being presented was as good as it could be. And I will tell you, it goes before 2012. I mean, when we were in Iraq, and we still had decisions to be made before there was a decision to pull out of Iraq in 2011. I mean, it was very clear what we were going to face.
Well, I admire your frankness
very
on this subject.
Very clear what we were going to
let
face.
Before we move on, just to clarify once more, you are basically saying that even in government at the time, you knew those groups were around, you saw this analysis, and you were arguing against it. But who wasn't listening?
I think the administration.
So the administration turned a blind eye to your analysis?
I don't know if they turned a blind eye. I think it was a decision. I think it was a willful decision.
A willful decision to go support an insurgency that had Salafists, Al-Qaeda,
and
Muslim Brotherhood.
A willful decision to do what they're doing, which you'd have to really ask the president, what is it that he actually is doing with the policy that is in place? Because it is very, very confusing. I'm sitting here today, Mehdi, and I can't tell you exactly what that is. And I've been at this for a long time.
All right, y'all. So here we are. That was the former head of the DIA, General Michael Flynn, in this great interview. You guys got to see this whole thing. There's so much newsworthy stuff in this interview. It'll blow your mind. Al Jazeera head-to-head. We're on the line with Brad Hoff from LevantReport.com. And I forget, Brad, you're former Army or former Marines in Iraq?
What was it? Former Marines, and I was attached to a headquarters unit stuck around Washington, D.C.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I'm sorry. I was thinking of somebody else, actually. But anyway, and then after you got out of the Marines, then you went and lived in Syria for a while, as we discussed before on the show.
Exactly. Had an apartment in Damascus, lived there off and on from about 2004 to 2009, 2010 range.
Okay, good deal. So that explains your at least partial expertise and certainly your interest in this subject for talking about it here. A hell of a lot more than I've got. So now, one of the things that you say at the beginning of your article here in remarking upon that exchange that we just heard is you say that it's amazing that Flynn actually seemed to take issue with the way that Mehdi Hasan posed the question about American awareness of the rise of the Islamic State in August of 2012. What do you mean by that?
Oh, exactly. I mean, we already know that Flynn was at odds with the White House over the rise of ISIS. We know that he briefed the White House in February 2014. He predicted that ISIS would sweep through Iraq, and it was soon after that briefing that he retired. It was widely reported that he was fired, that he was at odds over ISIS policy. And, of course, we know that ISIS did sweep through Iraq. But what's significant here is that this is really the highest level former intelligence official to really confirm all of this face-to-face. Right, with an Al Jazeera reporter. Al Jazeera's Mehdi Hasan had the document in hand. He's holding it up, and hugely significant, because to my knowledge, no one at this level has ever fully acknowledged the way that Flynn does, that we were basically arming al-Qaeda. And, of course, Flynn is a major hawk. Flynn's a major hawk, and strangely, his what I think is a contradictory argument is that we should have done more earlier. It seems like he was arguing for some kind of bigger, overt intervention, maybe in 2011, early 2012. But even he is now acknowledging that this whole covert program to arm the rebels in northern Syria ultimately resulted in ISIS, as he and the DIA warned in no uncertain terms with this document.
Right. Okay. And now that's the part that I edited out just for time's sake, because it takes a while to get all the best sound bites out of that clip there. It's already 2.5 minutes long. People can go to the article or to at antiwar.com or at your website, Levant Report. They can watch the whole interview. Again, I urge people to watch the entire interview. And that's one of the subjects that I think we need to get back to would be these mythical moderates. I just didn't want to waste people's time on that because that's kind of the real non-answer there. But so a couple things to cover here, first of all. I think first and foremost is he's acknowledging the importance of this document. Now, I have a friend who I think is, he's a Twitter friend, who I think is military, or maybe he's a contractor for the military or something. He knows about things like this. At least he's a veteran, and says, you know, look, the military, the DIA and the rest of it, it's a socialist bureaucracy. And everybody, you know, CCs everybody on everything, but that doesn't mean anything. You know, it's like the movie Brazil or something. It's just a piece of paper with some things on it. It doesn't mean necessarily that anybody important saw it, understood it, discussed it, cared about it, anything. In fact, you'd expect to find really great stuff in documents like that. You would not expect to hear the principals talk about the really great stuff because it doesn't get that high, you know, that kind of thing. And and maybe that's true 90% of the time, but sure doesn't look like it's true in this case when the former head of the DIA is confirming that he took this to the White House, or, you know, brought the issue up to the White House, and that they discussed it in the most frank terms. And no, this was no mistake. They knew exactly what they were doing. And now the music's playing and we got to go to break. And when we get back, we're going to talk about just what he means by, about back in the mythical moderates and what he means about they knew what they were doing, too. So hang tight, Brad Hoff, right after this.
Hey, I'll Skull Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Brad Hoff from LevantReport.com. We're talking about that DIA document from August of 2012 about the rise of the Islamic State. And now this new interview by General Michael Flynn, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, with Al Jazeera. And I know you guys hear this at the top of the show every day, but I wanted to play a clip and actually two different clips of Hillary Clinton here. These are both from the very beginning of March 2012, even before this DIA report. Very beginning of March 2012 on CBS News. And she's being asked the question, of course, from the right, how come we're not doing more to help the rebels in Syria? And here's how she responds in two parts.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
All right, so she was secretary of state at the time there. And then, of course, that was her last year in office. And after the election, she resigned and handed the reins over to Kerry. And as soon as she was out, she put in the New York Times, Brad, that, well, me and Panetta and Petraeus all wanted to arm up the rebels more, and Obama wouldn't let us do it. And yet there she is explaining in a perfectly cogent manner exactly why not to do that. These are the veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Exactly, and even connected with this DIA report, if you go look at NBC archives of White House briefings in September 2014, I think specifically September 29th, White House spokesman said, hey, that's the day they came out, said everyone was surprised over the rapid advance of ISIS. It was kind of like, where did they come from? Our intel agencies just didn't see them coming. I even think the CIA was thrown under the bus at that time. And, of course, now we have Flynn. We have this this document. I mean, there it is in clear words, confirming that, at the very least, the White House was lying. I think the common people, they know what's happening. But what's great about, you know, Flynn in retirement, singing like a bird, mm-hmm. is that, well, we have the insiders coming forward telling us that this is the case.
Sure.
And here we have the document to prove it.
That's right. So, yeah, I mean, this is, for anybody who already knows this stuff, well, duh, guys, but hey, we're just trying to be, you know, as careful as we can and dot as many I's and cross as many T's as we can. But yes, it's a fact that in 2011, the dawn of the Arab Spring, there was a report immediately in The Guardian, but I forget the guy's name, who said Prince Bandar is sending Mujahideen to Syria right now. And then about a week later, Eric Margolis came out and said, I just got back from France, where I talked to all my friends and friends in French intelligence and in the French military, and they've got special forces on the ground right now leading the rebellion. And so, and then by December 2011, we had Phil Giraldi in the American Conservative magazine saying that there's a brand new finding that is a secret order by the President of the United States authorizing the CIA to increase covert action against Iran and Syria. And that was, you know, months before we even had that quote from Hillary. So, yeah, certainly knew what was going on. And I have a story from the Future Freedom Foundation, Stupidity or the Plan, that came out a year before the fall of Mosul. And it was right at the point where the Islamic State was basically renaming al-Nusra the Islamic State before al-Nusra said, no, we're still al-Nusra, and Zawahiri told the Islamic State to go back to Iraq, and then all that happened, whatever. It was right in the middle of that, but I was saying, look, they've just renamed it the Islamic State, and look where they are. They're in lawless territory where the government of Iraq has no influence there. And the government of Syria has no influence there. And so it's just a snap of a fingers for the Islamic State to go from the name of a group to an actual place. It's right. Bin Laden's wildest dream when he was locked in his attic in 2011 became literally the reality within 2 years because of the USA.
Right. And speaking of Bin Laden and Zawahiri, you know, connected with General Flynn, during that key time, we're talking, I think, something like 2004 to 2007, was a senior intelligence officer for JSOC, okay? For a couple years, he was chair of the Military Intelligence Board, and I think that was 2012 to 2014. I mean, this guy was one of the inner circle guys in terms of the global hunt for Al-Qaeda. And
JSOC
the
being
same guy.
Higher than SOCOM. SOCOM is the Special Operations Command. JSOC is an entirely different chain of command, basically answerable only to the president. Well, I don't know exactly how they structure it under Obama, but they are the
right.
elite, the very top tier Special Forces, SEAL Team 6 and the Delta Force, not the Rangers and Force Recon.
Exactly, and that's why people need to watch this interview. I mean, we're talking like 5-6 full minutes of Flynn talking about this document. And you know what? You're exactly right in terms of, yeah, these documents circulating around the halls of the Pentagon and the State Department can be a dime a dozen. It's true. But here we have Flynn saying, for it to even reach his desk, for him to say, I use this as, you know, one among other source materials to argue with the White House, that means this report was significant. And, you know, early on after I did my initial reporting back in May over this document, I had people pile on me, you know, both online and in personal emails. And, you know, the assumption of all was just that, oh, this couldn't have been important. This wasn't seen by anyone. But, no, interestingly, Marcy Wheeler, writing in Salon.com in, I think, June, was the only one to really do her homework, you know, legal-wise, connected with the Judicial Watch's FOIA request. Okay, and so in her Salon article, I think it was called the Benghazi Scandal We Should Really Be Talking About, mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, she pulled the terms through which Judicial Watch originally received the document. And Judicial Watch received them, you know, based on this this finding. Any and all records produced by any official of the DOD or state in preparation for, use during, or pursuant any briefing of congressional leaders and intelligence committee leaders. So at the very least, we know Congress saw this document too, or at least had it made available to them. And
right.
This means it was important. This means it wasn't just four guys in a basement saw it. And that was it. And yes, there's a likelihood that it actually came through maybe a liaison intelligence agency, but the fact that it was filtered up the chain of command so high, as Flynn now confirmed, means that this is a significant document. And frankly, I think every American should print it out, have it in their hands, and should be asking some serious questions.
Look, I mean, I hate sounding this extreme about it or whatever, but there ain't nothing else to call this but treason. And there's no way to deny
right.
it now. The head of the DIA says he argued with the White House that, look, we're backing Al-Qaeda. That's who's benefiting from this aid and comfort is Al-Qaeda, the group that is sworn in allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the only actual enemy the American people have on this planet other than our own government. And the Hillary Clinton, David Petraeus, Leon Panetta, you know, political operative response is, yeah, but we hate Assad more because that's what Israel and Saudi and Turkey want. I mean, it's treason. I don't care if we're allies with those guys. And in fact, to anyone who this just sounds completely incredible and you can't believe a word that you're hearing, I know I risk sounding like John Birch, but just go and look and check it out yourself. It's at foreignaffairs.com, the official journal of the most prestigious centrist foreign policy establishment think tank in America. 100 years old, the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs magazine from March 9th of this year, accepting Al-Qaeda. Accepting Al-Qaeda. They are our friends in Syria. And we saw in the news just last week where, 2 weeks ago, where they sent the DOD-trained soldiers in. They thought they were going to join up with al-Nusra to fight ISIS. And al-Nusra immediately captured them and turned on them. And the Americans complained to the New York Times that, well, we expected to be greeted as allies by these guys because we've been treating them as our allies. This is exactly the way that the ambassador got killed in Benghazi, too, Brad, was they put him in the middle of the hornet's nest, fighting for his enemies, and then, surprise, they stung him.
Well, look, when I was in the military, there was a notion of lawful orders, right? And we all took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution from enemies, foreign and domestic. And I've had conversations, usually email exchanges with some friends that I still have, like in the intelligence world and around D.C. And, they know what's going on. They know the game. But, of course, they tell me, look, intelligence doesn't set policy, and that's true, right? The job of intelligence and the lower levels is to paint as accurate a picture as possible, and that's what we have in this DIA document. And yeah, they can make noise about it, but it's true, their hands are tied. But I typically respond to them, look, I know it's hard, but we all took an oath here, and illegal criminal orders are no valid orders at all. In fact, I was expressly given a class in the military stating that. And so the fact is, if you're some low-level intel guy and you're supposed to train a group of Syrian recruits with beards down to their bellies who are talking about establishing some kind of Salafist or Islamic State, I would argue that whatever orders you've been given, those are not lawful, valid orders.
Yeah, and you know what? If you're brave enough to risk your skin killing innocent people and maybe getting maimed or dying in one of these ridiculous wars, then you ought to be brave enough to take some documents and go on 60 Minutes and maybe have to do a little bit of prison time or flee to Russia for a few years like Snowden or something to tell the truth to the American people. And we saw when the lobby was trying to get us to bomb Syria in 2013 that all of these soldiers started putting on YouTube and on Facebook these meme pictures of them covering their face, but you can tell they're wearing fatigues, and their sign says, I didn't join up the service to fight for Al-Qaeda. And,
right.
I mean, you're talking, they're facing mutiny, because the word gets around quick. These guys aren't the most sophisticated about who's who in geopolitics and whatever, but the word gets around quick that, hey, you hear Obama's thinking about having us fight for the Al-Qaeda guys in Syria now, they can understand that. You know what I mean? They're pissed.
Yeah. No, exactly. And the media, too. Mainstream media, too. I mean, we have so much information. I mean, we've got these, this physical DIA report in hand. You got guys like ex-CIA number two guy, Mike Morrell, going around, right? He's wanting to do the interviews. How hard is it to, like Al Jazeera, like Mehdi Hassan, how hard is it to put these questions to these guys? And that's what frustrates me. The Al Jazeera program, by the way, ran on Al Jazeera International on multiple days last weekend. The producer of Head to Head, which is the particular program, told me that it is likely set to air on Al Jazeera America. So hopefully there will be a broader American viewership. But you know what? It is up for paid media, paid journalists who have access. They need to print this document out, and they need to be asking Mike Morrell. They need to be asking the State Department. They need to be asking more questions of Mike Flynn or anyone who will talk, because there's plenty of guys going on these little book tours, and so it's up to the media to ask these questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really is, a big lie situation where it's just impossible to face up to the unface-up-toable or whatever, as Homer Simpson would say, right? Like, if one weekend on CNN, they have to finally go ahead and get it together and say, okay, actually, Assad is the strongest force on earth fighting against the Islamic State, and we don't know what in the world we were doing championing all the rest of his enemies, if not ISIS this whole time. This is crazy, you know. But hell, even Rand Paul, when he's trying to sort of kind of tell the truth about America's role in the rise of the Islamic State, at least in Syria, in the debate the other day, botched it so bad that it basically made no sense. I mean, there's nobody really on that level who's willing to say it, because again, and I know, I'm sorry, I go on and on, and I'm hyperbolic, and I'm repeating myself, but it's treason. There's no other way to call it other than treason when they're sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, and they've never been shy about it this whole time, and they still say they are, and America is still backing them. Even in 2015, they got this whole new PR thing to rebrand these guys as the moderate fighters compared to the Islamic State, instead of the obvious truth that it's Assad's army that is the moderate opposition to the Islamic State and al-Nusra.
Yeah, the official West-backed group in the North, I think, is calling themselves Army of Conquest. And the Army of Conquest, when they took Idlib, one of the first things they did, they burned to death two Syrian Christians who ran a liquor store, and of course then destroyed the liquor store. And there's all kinds of other horror stories like that. But you know what? You know,
yeah, murdering a bunch of Druze who refused to convert, too.
No, exactly. And the thing is, I'm not just griping about this in terms of griping about the past, and let's get the historical record straight. Americans need to realize that with this creeping no-fly zone, you know, in cooperation with Turkey, that's creeping over northern Syria, people need to realize that this is a path to all-out war. You know, if we just continue on this path, we're going to be yet in another disastrous conflict. And that's why, you know, information like this report, they're important, not just to getting the past record straight. It's important that Americans wake up and know the real game, what's really happening on the ground, and what our policies are doing, and what the policies of our allies like Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Qatar are doing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, think of it. What would happen if the foreign-backed forces were to really win out over the Syrian army, and what would be the fate of all the various sects of Christians, the Shia, the Druze, and the Alawites? What's the slogan is, what, kill all the Alawites and all the Christians to the sea, or all the Alawites to the grave, the Christians to the sea, or something like that?
No, exactly. And really, even any Sunni, any mainstream Muslim that is not on board with the radical sectarian vision,
which includes the majority of Sunnis in Syria right now, in fact.
Exactly. I mean, there's a West Point, a couple months ago, West Point put out an article called, the Syrian Sunnis and the regime's resilience. And it was fully acknowledged by a respected military institution that the majority of citizens that were sticking by the government were Sunnis, right? Not because they all hailed the government as the greatest thing in the world, but they realize that their sovereignty has been taken away a long time ago. Sadly, none of this is being decided by actual Syrians anymore.
Right. All right. Well, I've kept you way over time here, and I'll let you go. But thank you so much for your great coverage of this and for your patience while I'm screaming and yelling during your interview, too.
Oh, it was great. And look, everyone needs to watch this Al Jazeera report. Everyone needs to read the DIA document.
Yep. It's all right there. Check out LevantReport.com, Brad Hoff at LevantReport.com, and it's also in his archives at antiwar.com, original.antiwar.com/Brad_Hoff. It's called Former DIA Chief Warned White House of ISIS Rise. And if you're just looking for the interview, it's Mehdi Hassan with one S, Mehdi Hassan and Michael Flynn, General Michael Flynn, formerly the head of the DIA, on the show Head to Head, Al Jazeera show Head to Head. Thanks very much. I'll see you tomorrow.